It's a nice, horrible evening out there. And one of the great things about the fall and the winter are coming is this is a time to grab a book and curl up on a couch or curl up in your bed or curl up in a chair or curl up on the floor and read books. It is my real pleasure to have two astonishingly talented authors in here to talk about two books, their most recent books, which are vastly different, but I still thought, wow, these two people would be fun to have on the air together. Don't Let Me Down, Gint Eris. You've been on the show before.
Leave that to me.
Yeah, that's Kate Wiesel talking. Kate's collection of stories sort of interwoven. Is that a good phrase? The interwoven short stories. Her first published work, prize-winning work, Driving in Cars with Homeless Men, which is a great, great title. Gint's latest is the cutest little book you've ever seen about a topic that is not really the cutest thing in the world. It's called Relief by Execution, and it is done in a sort of small little format. These are two of the bright lights of the local literary scene, and we're going to spend this entire hour talking to you about their books.
Wonderful
and about the literary scene. Gint, you, when you found out that Kate Wiesel was going to be on, you dipped into her stories, didn't you? And?
She carries a switchblade in her boot, man. She's got a switchblade.
My heel?
Yeah. She's looking for blood, so be ready, readers.
Well, one of the things about both of these books is if there is a shadow on both of the stories. Yours is very personal. Again, yours is sort of a memoir. The violence is a huge thread in both books. Mm-hmm. Yours is very personal, is it not?
Yeah. My book is about simultaneously personal violence that occurs in domestic spaces, right? Violence against children. And also about, you know, this kind of global mentality of violence, a wide net of violence, so to speak, that causes things like genocides and concentration camps and such. And my book asks questions that attempt to link both spaces together.
Yeah. Talk to me about the personal part of it.
Well, I grew up...
I could, of course, read from it if you want.
If you want to do that, that's going to be poetic.
Well, I don't know about poetic, but... Father's beatings are completely different. There is no available urban planner, journalist, or nurse. In contrast to a street fight, when heightened awareness rushes up, father's beatings extinguish awareness. You disappear, and the aftermath can be similar to an alcohol-induced blackout.
Yes.
That's
which
pretty powerful writing.
Which lasts in some cases for decades.
Yeah. Well, in your case, it did. I mean, it did. Yeah, I mean, it did. This is something you had to cope with, right?
Yeah. I kind of woke up to the entirety of the reality of the physical abuse that I suffered as a child after having children myself, right? And after having a variety of experiences, one of which was a culminating one when I got robbed in a 7-Eleven in Oak Park.
Yeah.
Okay, and then following that, about 3 days or so, I felt more or less normal. But then following that third day, I just had this complete loss of mental capacity. It just disappeared, and then all these memories returned that to me seemed at the time to be imagined, right?
Yeah.
But then, you know, through therapy and meditation practice and other things, I was able to start kind of putting things together, and Relief by Execution is part of that. Actually, it's a representation of my ability to piece things together and make a whole narrative out of something that for most of my life was pure chaos.
Yeah. Well, you lost your anchor. I mean, you lost.
Yeah.
We all anchor ourselves. And in your book, Kate, it is about women. The titles of most of these stories in the book are the names of women. How was this book born? Because I'm fascinated with the way the lives of these women, you meet one and then it will intersect with another. How was the book born?
I had been with my friend in college who was telling me a story kind of late at night about her friend in high school whose boyfriend OD'd on heroin. And the night of his funeral, they slept in his bed. And it just kind of stopped me, this image of them in someone who had just died, his bed. Really, like, shocked me and moved me. And so I started writing a story about this girl whose boyfriend had OD'd on heroin. And I finished that story and still had an attachment to her. The character is Rafa. And I wondered who her friends were because she was so real to me. And I wondered about like my own high school experience and sort of based this book off my friends and myself, our lives.
You write in here, I'm going to read, I think, throughout the show, samples of both of their work, and this is, I'm only grabbing this paragraph because I outlined it, and it's about a bed. Frankie could pick a guy out of a lineup even if she wasn't the witness. That's what she does, picks. We live together in a two-bedroom split above Sal's Pizza where the dope heads blabber beneath our open window at night. Sometimes, when I can't sleep, I'll crawl into her bed. She lies on her side with her head propped in her palm, her sheets smelling like the department store with the sweet soak of her guest's perfume. It's confession, lying there in the dark while Frankie listens. Wrought iron shadows from branches partition the sheets. As she points sturdy words like vectors toward my heart, she knows things. She majors in human development. That means something to her since we both dropped out of school our first semester, failing being my specialty, then re-enrolled the next fall. I don't really care about school, specifically the part when men walk in and try to educate me. You are both teachers. I am really, we won't get into that aspect, but when did you two first come to writing? When does one say to themselves, I'm going, two-part question. I'm going / want to be a writer, and I am a writer. Gint, let's start with you.
Okay, the first part of the question for me is that I never imagined myself as much of anything else. I'm that unfortunate, cursed twit, right, who just did not. I have a vivid memory of looking at my bookshelf in my room, and I must have been, I don't know, I must have been in third grade, fourth grade.
You grew up in Cicero.
And grew up in Cicero, yeah. And I had a bookshelf in my room, and I was sitting there, and I had just faced the question, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I couldn't answer it. And I sat in my room and I looked at the
fourth grade, you're a cowboy,
no,
fireman.
But I didn't have an answer for these people. Yeah. I just didn't. And then I was sitting there, I was looking at the books, and I thought, well, of course, I want to make these, right? So I wanted to be a writer, and I can't. Then how do you become one? Well, you pick up a pen, man, and you start doing it, right? That's when.
Okay. Kate?
Yeah, I guess I sort of was thinking about this question, too, because I'd been asked it recently. Yeah,
sure.
And I mean, I guess there's no way to pinpoint it, but I was always acting as a kid, and even just with friends, I think we were so bored that we had this, like, do you remember, like, Girl Talk? It was, like, this cassette tape, and it had a little speaker, and we would just go insane all day with voices and characters, and then we upgraded to like an actual camcorder, and we used to steal it from my brother and just walk
around.
You
grew up in Boston, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, we weren't allowed to take the camcorder outside, but we did. And so we were always just doing voices and characters, and I was always really good.
So you were exercising your imagination at a certain point. And when do you then decide to, as Gint so poetically puts it, pick up a pen?
Yeah, I had dropped out of college, and I was working at Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
And writing, like, these little stories on wine sleeves, like, under the counter as people just confusedly walked up to my register. Like, where is this, where's this girl? And so I took a creative writing night class with a teacher named Jen DeLeon. She's a local Boston writer, and she was just the most, like, passionate teacher, and I can still hear her voice in my head. She's like, Kate, you're going to submit this story, and you're going to come with me to Guatemala and internship at this writing school in Boston, and you'll go back to school, you'll get your MFA, and so she's been in my life ever since.
Wow.
Yeah.
Those are good stories. We're going to continue on with the tale of two writers, Gint Harris and Kate Wiesel. Gint, You both have websites, which I think every author has to have now. Kate's is Kate Wise, KateWisel.com. Gint, your thing is, it's Liquid Ink is your the name of your, but that's not that's how to get there. It is GINT-ARAS.com. They are both lively. Kate has events planned out deep into 2020, and we will be back right after I read this to you. This is the only commercial I have to read, which is, and I want you two writers to judge how idiotic this commercial is. See what time it is? Like 17. Gint Aris and Kate Wisel are two of Chicago's most talented writers. Gint is a fiction writer, but his most recent book is an essay. I'm calling this an essay memoir.
An essay memoir is accurate, yeah. Accurate.
And Kate's collection of stories, Driving in Cars with Homeless Men, is the winner of the Drew Hines Literature Prize. What does that mean? I don't know, Drew Hines. Is it of the Hines family?
Yeah, ka-ching,
it is.
Ka-ching.
Oh, good. Then money. Then maybe you got some. Maybe you got some money with it, which is always good for authors.
And tomatoes.
Yeah.
I read somewhere your reaction to getting the prize. You were shocked, stunned, and
drugged and shot.
Eventually, very happy. But it's also, you said that's one of the reasons you're on this kind of tour that is lasting into next year, that it's given you in this weird publishing environment. It's heightened your profile, has it not?
I don't know. I just, it's this prize that they have a ton of money, and so I get to travel, which is great. But yeah, it was definitely a decision to do the prize versus like get an agent and do New York publishing. But what I really like about the prize is that I didn't have to change really much about my book. There isn't this big editing process where I had to like turn the book into like a chick lit summary or something.
Yeah, well, that it is not. one of my favorite people and favorite writers, Don DeGrazia, famously of American Skin, he's also a playwright. And he's from what I hear, I've certainly never taken a class with Don, but I'm sure he's a fantastic, exciting teacher. He writes of the book, an uncommon fearlessness, a precise confidence propels every sentence. Kate Wisel is an important new artist with a uniquely potent voice, and this debut is cause for celebration. I'll take that in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. Gint, your first book, Fugue, how long did it take you to write that, your first novel?
Oh, that took a long time. I started writing it in 2000. I had a draft in 2006. I tried to publish it. I failed. I put it to the side. I self-published a book, Finding the Moon in Sugar, and then was reading from it about a year and a half after it had come out. And a guy came up to me in a bar that had, I don't know, about seven or eight people in it, Reading Under the Influence. I don't know if you know that series.
Yes, I do.
Right?
Sadly.
And, yeah, so somebody came up and said, hey, do you have anything else? And I said, yeah, I got this, you know, 100,000-word book under my bed that's dusty. And the guy said, yeah, send it in. So, you know, within a month after that, I had a publishing contract for that book, right? But then I had to go back and look at it. Yeah. So I had nothing at all, and then in 24 hours I had a publisher, and that publisher went belly up in December of that year, and then by February or March of the next year I had a new publisher, right, because somebody else picked it up, Tortoise Books, here in Chicago. So that book had no audience and no publisher for 17 years or 15 years, and then within 3 months it had two publishers.
And it was up for some awards too, was it not?
It was a finalist. Honorable mention for the 2016 Chicago Writers Association's award for fiction, for novels. Yeah.
Both of you, as working writers, also teaching, your publishing stories are a little bleaker than Kate's are at this point. Did you have to? Did you shop this book around, Kate? I mean.
No, I was at a fellowship in Madison, and included with that fellowship was the opportunity to meet some agents, and so I had met an agent that...
sold it?
No. It was just a promising situation, but it came at the time when I found out about the prize, so it was sort of like this, like, sick decision I had to make.
Gotcha.
And everyone said, oh, it's such a good decision to have. It's such a good problem to have.
But not as if any problem would be good. Then it's, you know, it's not like flipping a coin. I mean, you're talking about years and years of your fate are being decided.
Yeah, it feels like a twin gets born when you have to make a decision like that.
How long did it take to put this together?
And
when did you envision it as the kind of interwoven series of stories that it is?
Yeah, I sort of talked about Benny's Bed, the story about Rafa in high school whose boyfriend overdoses.
Yeah.
And I guess the best way I can talk about the structure is to then talk about a moment I had in a Cape House, like years later, my brother's Cape House. And there was like all this paraphernalia there, and there was a squatter living in the house. So again, I was like taken to the page, and only halfway in, I realized, of course, the speaker is Rafa, a girl who's like mid-divorce and is like attaching herself to this addict in the hopes of reclaiming some kind of past life. And so the structure works like that. It goes back and forth in time and webs, and I wanted it to be like a crash, all the stories. I like how you talked about violence, like the aftermath, and sort of like the reckoning, I guess. The stories are about the reckoning.
Sure.
So the trajectory is where the blank space is.
Well, and there, you know, in the thing, there are portions of the histories of these people that aren't there.
Yeah.
I mean, you're like catching up with people you haven't seen for a while, and you're not, and they're not saying, well, and then I went here, and then I was with this guy.
Yeah.
I find it, fascinating. I'm terribly compelling. I think people into that world of, oh, I just want the straight narrative, and I want the woman to go here, and then I want her to go here, and then I want her to find love, are not, don't buy this book.
Well,
but everybody else who loves good writing should buy this book.
I feel like every like incoming MFA student, I was just like such a sucker for Jesus Son by Dennis Johnson, and it had such an impact.
Yeah, sure, sure, sure.
So I, like you were saying...
Well, I'm going to ask you both after the commercial break, which is coming right about now. Dan Long, the great engineer here, keeps me on track now that we don't have music to play and stuff. I want to ask about influences, too, because I don't know. I've had a couple of writers on who go, no one influenced me. I go, have you never read a book? Yeah, what's the matter with you? I think influences are terribly, terribly important to people. We'll take a commercial break. Kate and Gint will stretch their legs. We're also here with Cheryl Johnston, who does more for the book world in Chicago than anybody I know, except for some publisher who would give prizes to people. I love the notion of prizes and that doing its part for literature. We'll be back in a couple minutes, then you'll get some news, and then we will continue on with these fine writers.
What crazy, incredulous stuff.
Now, thank you, Roger Badish. I am with Ms. Kate Wiesel and Mr. Gint Aris. Kate's latest and first book, Driving in Cars with Homeless Men, is one of the most compelling and artful reads I have experienced in as long as I can remember. I mean, you write beautiful dialogue. You have... a very imaginative mind, and you seem, for someone so young, to really understand the nature of light and dark human beings. So take that as a compliment. What made you or drew you to Columbia College in Chicago? You're from Boston to get your MFA.
This is going to sound so lame and stupid.
It's the only place I could get in.
I always wanted to move to Chicago since I was a little kid. Because
why?
That's not
because
lame.
Why?
No.
That's not lame.
It gets worse.
That's cool.
Because of the Babysitter's Club series, where little sister Karen lives in Chicago after her parents get divorced.
Wow, what a compelling reason to move to Chicago. And you looked at various programs at universities and colleges here?
I only applied to Columbia.
Did you?
Yeah.
Why?
My friend who went to that workshop I went to in Guatemala that my teacher had me go to went to Columbia, and so she just recommended it to me, and I came and visited her, and we went together, and I saw that the school had green railings, and I was like, I'm in. Mm-hmm. I want to come.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. You met people like Don DeGrazia.
Mm-hmm.
You met people like Jim DeRogatis.
Mm-hmm.
You've done work for Jim, right?
You've
helped him research. Jim is, as those of you who listen to the show know and read, you should read Soulless. It is one of the most remarkable books ever written about. It's a crime story, but it's also a real Chicago story. This book will go down as one of the most important books ever written about Chicago during the time R. Kelly was being R. Kelly. Did you help him with the book at all, Kate? You must have read it.
Yeah.
And I'm not wrong. This book is brilliant.
I worked on research, and I worked on a lot of transcription, so it was...
Well, that...
I mean, it was like, at one point, I was like, I told Jim to give me more, like, he calls them... Well, anyways, he was like, it's so odd that you want to keep transcribing this, and you're getting, like, enjoyment from it, but it felt so... It's like you're a journalist chasing down the story type excitement, where it felt proactive and it felt like I was doing something.
Well, it also you were helping give these young women many a voice.
Yeah, and I was sort of learning the story as it came to me through the transcripts out of order, but it sort of weirdly mimicked my book structure and the way that it came to me, which is like a web, and that you sort of have to like figure it out as you go. So it was. I mean, totally painful to be transcribing
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
I was like, why am I smoking again?
What? Yeah. Why am I using drugs?
Yeah.
Why am I drinking and smoking?
Yeah.
Like Rick Kogan. Again, your relief by execution is intensely personal, too. I mean, intensely personal. There's some dark things in this thing, too. Is that a struggle? That's
a good question.
Get that out.
Well, I don't write just about violence and trauma. I also write about,
Your kids,
convalescence,
and
health. Right, and part of being healthy is to be clear about what's going on and what's going
and
on.
Honest with yourself. Yeah.
You know, who am I, and how does my mind work? What does my mind do to protect me from truth? Because the truth is too difficult to deal with, right?
Well, that's interesting.
So,
yeah.
I'm sure that you know you came up with something while you were looking at these transcripts of violence, but when you're looking at violence that has occurred to someone else, and then you realize that you're just not admitting what violence occurred to yourself, or that you have some defense mechanism that just kicks in to keep you from seeing it, you know, the question of violence becomes really personal. It becomes really intimate, and so I certainly explore that here, but the kind of arc in Relief by Execution for me, and there's a byline too, right? A visit to Mauthausen is that, you know, I took this trip to a concentration camp to get as close to a question that I don't want to give away because it's a punchline.
But
to get as close to a question about the nature of how violence affects identity, and then how identity is affected by your attempt to treat it, you know, or your attempt to rationalize.
Well, you write in here, addressing that very observation, is you write, we Lithuanians have a knotty relationship with our history.
Yeah.
And you, being Lithuanian, have a knotty relationship with your own history.
Yeah. Well, the personal and the collective, those are, whether or not those two things are separate is a good question.
Yeah.
I'm a child of World War II war refugees.
Yep.
Right. And I grew up in Cicero.
Yeah.
And most of the people that were, you know, my elders' friends were war refugees.
Sure.
So, you know, you're dealing with dozens of traumatized people. You're dealing with an entire parish of traumatized people, you know, who, to a large degree, you know, we're unaware of what PTSD is or anything like that. So the way they dealt with it was, you know, usually by self-medicating or by praying.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Yeah.
So this book is an attempt to kind of, you know, push that thing to another level and to try.
Well, you do it. It's published. I mean, Kate Wiesel and I are very taken with the format of this book.
I love it. It's so cute.
Yeah,
it's the size of a wallet.
It is. It's the size of, well, it's, you know, about the size of a phone.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
An iPhone, yeah. I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bound book. It's one part of the Little Bound Books essay series from, what's the name of this publisher?
Homebound Publications.
Homebound Publications. How did you find these guys? This is like the perfect size for this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I also...
Well, yeah, yeah, traveling Bible. Yeah. How do you find these people?
They kind of found me. You've
been writing more and more essays.
I had been writing nonfiction following the fugue just because people had been asking me for it. And this guy came to me and said, you know, there's the series of books, and I think you'd be really good for it. Just pitch them a couple of ideas.
This is great. The first fugue came around because some guy came up to you in a bar and said, you got a book? I mean, we got anything under your bed?
I have only ever been published out of a slush pile once, right? Everything else has either been things at readings or conversations with people in bars. That kind of stuff. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so this guy comes up to me and he says, you know, pitch him something. So I pitched three or four ideas and they decided to do this one.
Wow, I'm very taken with it, and as is Kate. I just think it's a lovely format. It reminds me of the local publisher Mouse Books. There's a Mouse Book Club that is going to start publishing original stuff. They just have published their first original thing. In your book, Kate, there's a... It's not... There's violence, but it's also about... You know, there's abuse of a wide range of different kinds of abuse.
Yeah. I think when I was writing it, I didn't even realize... This is all pre-Me Too, of course. And I don't know, maybe it was my pre-response to Me Too. Like, all these things were swirling around. But really, it didn't feel like anything because these are just such like common experiences for women. These are just the stories.
Do you two like to read in public?
No.
I do. I really like it. Just like Kate, she was talking about being an actress earlier.
Yeah.
I really wanted to be an actor when I was a kid. And so reading kind of gives me the vicarious thrill of you standing in front of people and pretending I'm an actor for 10 minutes.
Yet another one of those acting jobs you don't get paid for. Exactly. That's the other great thing about it.
But you don't have to be a waiter to make up for it.
We're going to continue on. We're going to take one last break and continue on with these fine writers. Again, go to the websites. If we haven't intrigued you enough about the books themselves, and I think we have, go to Kate Wiesel, KateWiesel.com. And then, or before or after, it doesn't matter what order you go in to buy these two books, GINT-ARAS.com. Kate only has one book available now. I'm sure, you know, if I'm still have this radio show in 20 years, there'll be a shelf full of books. Gint has a number of three, and plus the new one, the little one.
The little important one. The iPhone size.
The iPhone size book. So go to those two websites after the show and explore further. I'll be back with these two fine people in 3 minutes.
Well, the time has arrived. It's time to put the plants to bed. Winterizing your garden. There's experts on that, and we have one.
It's us, Phil and Wendy, tomorrow morning at 10.
WGN. Nothing makes your hair stand up quite like an electrical problem, so trust the experts at ABC and consider it done. Our trustworthy, certified electricians are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to fix your problem the right way. Because with electricity, you want to consider it safe and you want to consider it done. Schedule today at 4abc.com. That's the number 4abc.com. ABC Plumbing, Sewer, Heating, Cooling, and Electric. Consider it done.
Real ID is a new optional form of identification for people who travel domestically. Now, you won't need a Real ID to drive a car or get a bank account or adopt that cute golden doodle that you've always wanted. But starting October 1st, 2020, you'll need a real ID or a valid passport in order to fly.
Head on over to realid.ilsos.gov to learn more. If you do choose Real ID, just follow these steps. First, visit a Secretary of State Driver Services facility to take a new photo. Make sure to bring a proof of identity and proof of social security number. You'll also need two proof of Illinois residency documents. During your visit, you'll receive a temporary paper license. Then you'll receive your new Real ID in the mail within 15 business days.
Be patient and prepared with the necessary documents when visiting a facility.
You have until October 1st, 2020 to get one. Just head on over to realid.ilsos.gov or call 833-503-4074 for more information.
Offer not valid in all states or where prohibited by law. Loans are subject to lender approval. See website for details.
Need cash but have bad credit or maxed out cards? Now you can get a personal loan for up to $5,000, whatever your credit, with no paperwork. 27cash.com is one of the nation's largest personal loan networks. If you have a checking account and a regular income source, you can get cash in your account as soon as tomorrow. Type this into your smartphone or computer address bar. www.27cash.com. That's 27cash.com. 27cash.com.
See, the conversation always continues off air. Kent was just telling us a story. Now, Kate, you're going to be reading somewhere, doing a book signing. What are you doing this Thursday?
Yeah, on Thursday I'm going to be reading with Jeremy T. Wilson at City Lit Books. Yeah.
Do you like doing that?
I do.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. You also, again, read that thing. We're doing a free commercial here.
Oh, my next appearance is November 14th at the Oak Park Mays branch of the library, where I am giving a lecture and leading a discussion about Hemingway's Movable Feast.
Wow.
And expatriate culture, Paris in the 20s.
Yeah, this is a well-rounded guy. What's Hypertext? We both like Hypertext.
Hypertext is a magazine.
Aren't they doing something?
They are.
There you go.
Yeah, here it is. 10 years of fiction, essays, poetry, and visual art, November 13th, right on Hypertext. It's a reading and fundraiser hosted by Hypertext Magazine and Studio, 5:30 to 8:30 at the Hideout here in Chicago.
Thank you, Ben Tanzer. That is a personal favor from the three of us, from Kate, Rick, and Gint. Do you both find yourselves on this? The Chicago literary community, which Cheryl Johnson knows as well as anybody, is a little diffuse now, to me at least. How do you feel about it? Do you feel a part of it, Gint?
I do, most certainly. Yeah. Now, what's interesting is that I'm learning how much bigger it is than what I'm aware of, right? And this is probably because of the diffusion that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Right? You know, Chicago is a segregated city. Chicago is a city that has borders and divisions that are abstract, and the writing community is, you know, as Chicago as anything else, and so that thing's true. So some of the stuff that's happening on the South Side, Northsiders don't know about, et cetera, et cetera, right? So
good point.
The more of it you see, the more you realize that it's not really one community, it's a series of communities.
That's
and
interesting.
Linking them together, I think, is really interesting, actually.
Yeah. Well, that's what Columbia College's famous Story Week used to be kind of in the business of doing until they, you know, ran out of money or whatever their problem is over at Columbia College. How do you feel about it, Kate? Because you're new. Knowing Jim DeRogatis is a good step, and Don DeGrazi are a good step in the right direction. But you're relatively new to it. This is your first book. Do you feel part of a Chicago? You were drawn to Chicago. It's obviously satisfied you on a number of levels. You're teaching here at Columbia and soon at Loyola. Do you feel part of the writers' community?
I do and I don't. And I like feeling both because I would never want to feel fully immersed in anything.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm sort of fresh out of my MFA program and then my fellowship at Madison. So it's been a while since I haven't been with like a group of, like a family of writers all together. So this year has been a little bit different, but I've gotten to meet Cheryl Johnston, my publicist.
Yeah, she's great. I mean, she really is
a
connector, as they say, as Malcolm Gladwell coined the word or something. What do you think of, give me a state of the health of, I know it's a tough question to answer in 5 minutes, but the health of Chicago publishing and literature.
Well, it's healthier than it was 5 years ago.
Right? How so?
Well, because certain publishers that started at that time have stayed around.
Yeah, right? Good
And
point.
They've published a bunch of stuff, and some of them are growing. You also have bookstores, for example, the Book Table in Oak Park, which is one of my favorite bookstores in the world, is growing, right? It's renting property that used to be next door, which is obviously a result of people coming in and buying books there, right? So it's from one point of view, it's dire and diffuse, but from another, if you start thinking about what kind of models for longevity have some of these publishers come up with, the old, you know, big publisher model isn't going to work start a new publisher. You can't do that. But you can do these small independent publishing houses that can grow and that can publish stuff that the big houses don't do.
Well, the great thing, that you bring up is the health of bookstores. I mean, literally, if we were having this conversation 10 years ago, we'd all be saying, oh my God, there are not going to be any bookstores in 10 years. You know, Barnes & Noble closed. But that is not true. You know, places like the Bookseller, I mean, I can go on and on and on.
The Bookseller volumes in Wicker Park.
Yeah.
Open books. I mean, Chicago has amazing bookstores. Really, really good ones.
Do you think so too, Kate? I mean, you have.
Yeah, I can only compare it to Boston because I'm from Boston. And
yeah.
I mean, Boston has like the Harvard Bookstore and the Brookline Booksmith, but there's like 20 times as many bookstores in Chicago, at least from what I've seen. And Chicago's so much livelier and more vibrant.
So you made the right decision to fall in love with it because of the Babysitter's Club or whatever. Yeah. Whatever
was also motivating. Vibe. You know, you don't feel like you're always networking the way you do when you're in New York. You know, when you go to a literary event in New York, it's just like, okay, business cards and names and this and that. Whereas in Chicago, you can just sit down and have a beer, you know, and talk about the
hockey. I think in your case, though, when you go to a bar, someone will come up and give you a publishing deal. That's the difference. There's less BS here than there is in New York. Gint goes to a bar, he gets published.
Yeah.
Kate hasn't explored the bars as much as Gint has, but she will. She will. What do you guys get out of teaching? Gint, you've been doing it longer than Kate. What do you get out of teaching?
Connection to youth, an awareness of contemporary issues that are affecting young people, a hands-on view into American corruption, an awareness of how academic publishers and test companies are, you know, screwing up people's minds, right? So It's a laboratory. That's really interesting.
Yeah. You too, Kate? I mean,
I was teaching comp and I'm going to teach literature, and I taught fiction at Madison, so I've sort of taught a variety of different like English comp classes.
Madison's a nice town.
Talk about bars.
All right, I'll ask one more question. It's been a delight to have you two on, and you two will be buddies now. I know this. And you'll read each other. That's the best thing. That's really the best thing. So, Kate Wiesel and Gint Aris. Gint, you first. What writer has most influenced your work? I don't care if it's someone you read when you were four.
Most? Overall, it's probably...
Or content, and maybe who you go back to every once in a while.
Recently, I've been going back to James Baldwin over and over and over again.
Nice.
I became obsessed with James Baldwin is probably the strongest influence behind Relief by Execution.
Wow. Right?
And that's the book begins with a quote from Native Son.
Yeah, I know.
But overall, it's Dostoevsky. Right, I'm one of those guys that really likes those long Russian books with
dark books,
drama
then,
and murder and
dark
people
books.
Fainting and all that.
That's great. That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Kate, what about you?
I like this. She's not obscure at all, but her name's Brenda Shaughnessy. She's a poet. I started reading her when I was younger, and she's like just like a wordsmith. And she has like four collections of poetry, I think now, maybe five. I just read if it's her fifth. And it's just so creative and brilliant.
Well, I think you two will both inspire young writers, and you will delight readers of fiction and essays. Fugue's a good book, man. You know that I think that.
No, I'm really excited.
I'm not a publisher, but I would have published it, and I had you on the radio show to talk about it. It's been great to have you. Kate, it's great to meet you, and good luck. Good luck. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Oh, don't be silly. You guys were great. It was just an interesting
Wait, we can't stay?
Pardon me?
We can't stay? No, I'm just kidding.
Go to
room for a bed in the corner.
The website. Yeah, let's stay on until 3 in the morning. If we could drink in here, I might think about that. Go to KateWisel.com. You will learn all about Kate and her remarkable book, Driving in Cars with Homeless Men, and about her event Thursday at City Lit. And go to GINT-ARAS.com, because Gint does a lot of writing for his website. A lot of writing for his website.
I was looking at it today.
Pardon, yeah, I know. It's really cool, isn't it? And much of it should be collected in this form. I'm charmed by this form, by the Little Bound Books essay series. His is titled Relief by Execution. You two are the real deal, and it's an honor to know both of you.
Thank you for
having us. And Cheryl Johnston, thanks for all you do for this wicked, wild community. I'm not sure I'm on next week because there's some Bears game, Hawks game, who knows? I don't know. But I will be on one of these Sundays very soon. So thanks for listening. Here, now listen to some commercials.